and we're ready for our next speaker.
He'll talk to you. We're waiting on his mama. She's going to come over here.
I really was.
My conscience woke me up and raised my watch case. Hey, no fair.
I'm really proud of some of you. I saw you around the pool with your swimsuits on, and by golly, you're here. As of now, you're locked into Mexico if you're signed up. you can't get out of it, or I keep your money. Yeah. A couple of you talked to me ahead of time and made some arrangements, but we have to cut it off, otherwise we're going to have a bus carrying one person. Now, the problem is that we have to have 60, and we're currently at 59, and we're just about to tell somebody that they can't back out. So, if you've given us your money, you're locked in. Okay, I'm not even going to try to introduce Pat again. I did such a fantastic job. Everybody's very happy. Pat, in 20 years of information conferences, I've never heard such glowing comments at lunch about someone. Thanks a lot. Here we go.
This morning I was dressed like a consultant. This afternoon I'm dressed like an actor.
Memorability? The reason I don't want you to forget that I'm dressed like an activist is because, unfortunately, we have a stereotype that activists look like I do now. You know, sandals, beard, long hair, sort of. And something is happening in the 80s, and that is that the activists now look like I looked this morning. I think they wear coats, too. And the implications of this, I don't think we're even beginning to understand. I know I'm not beginning to understand it for my clients yet. Let me paint some pictures for you just to give you an idea of where I'm coming from on that viewpoint. The most active group in terms of public perceptions in the last 2 years has certainly been the religious right. And as you know, they dress, act, and think very conservative. This is a denial, if you will, of the stereotype of the activist that looks like I do now. But the interesting thing is that the tactics change very little. And what I really want to share with you is some of what I have learned, and I was very unfair to you this morning. I didn't give you a chance to ask a lot of questions. I don't like that, but I was going somewhere and I wanted to get there before lunch. And I'd like now to have us spend a lot of time on questions and really get down to some specifics that you face. I mean, assume that I am a consultant brought here by you and that you have a chance to ask your consultant what he would do on a certain issue and be formulating some of those questions. This change to a conservative activist doesn't mean, of course, that the activists dressed like me are going to go away. What it means in a funny way, at best, at least that I can fathom it, is something very good. Now I know when you're sitting out there and the animal welfareists are knocking at the door, you wonder if this could possibly be good. But the fact is that this is good as far as I can see it at all for this reason. As recently as the 1950s, this country was really not, despite all our boasts and all that we taught kids in school, it really wasn't an awfully open and mobile society for the great majority of the people. There are always the Horatio Alger stories, the few people who had moved within society. And we always made a big thing of those to prove that we were a people who allowed folks to do their thing. But some historians, in analyzing the 50s, a time when I see many others in this room like myself were alive and kicking, analyzing that period now feel that it may have been the most repressive single decade in American history. If you think about it, it was just before there were any civil rights for minorities. It was just before it was even socially acceptable to demand civil rights for minorities. It was the era of McCarthyism. It was the era of the man in the gray flannel suit, the absolute conformity picture. And these historians are saying that it had never been quite that bad in all of American history. Well, as often happens, our response in this country to that has been to see that this was not our ideal picture, as painted by Tom Jefferson and Ben Franklin and the others. And with a marvelous self-righting system that our democracy is, we've now moved to what I think is a good situation, but one which is guaranteed to create employment for us from now on. And that is that everybody can be an activist on everything. Now, the criticism that you hear of this is that it's fragmenting American politics, that we no longer can get a true majority together to make any national unity. That may be so, but I have a hunch that will right itself also. In fact, I think there's some evidence it's happening right now. The positive side of it, as I see it, is what we call the New American Revolution. The real understanding, the perception by youngsters that indeed a person does matter. We've talked about that forever, but until now I submit to you that the real ability to say, hey, I don't like that social policy, I don't like that economic situation, I had some questions about that organization, until now we could go home and grumble. Today we have actually institutionalized that kind of activism. And if you want to read the great activist statement of all times, just read the Declaration of Independence. Because as I understand it, that's just what Thomas Jefferson was talking about. It was a place where people not only had a right to go into the court of public opinion, but they understood the responsibility to do so. Now, there's a problem in all this, and I think that problem may affect you in a funny kind of a way. Some of America's old line institutions, believe it or not, don't understand the court of public opinion. A couple of examples. The federal budget has recently done pretty unfriendly things to higher education and to social service agencies. We published another newsletter called Channels, which circulates to nonprofit institutions. And I was absolutely amazed through the newsletter contacts, plus through my own clients in those areas, to find that college presidents and the heads of organizations for the mentally retarded were actually afraid to speak up. They said, yeah, but I'll make Senator so-and-so mad. Or I will, you know, get all the bureaucrats in Washington unhappy with me. Well, clearly that is not how the system works. I hope I was able to show them that the ones that speak up the loudest usually get the most attention from the bureaucrats and the senators. But I think this is relevant to you because in my personal work, in dealing with saving farmland in the Northeast, in dealing with taxation for farmers, both the state and land taxation, I have found a strain of that kind of feeling among farmers. And what I find in your situation is the Farm Bureau organization out here taking a position and you doing your best, and one hell of a lot of members way down here still kind of wondering if it's really a good idea to get your name in the paper, except when you're born, get married, and die, the good old Yankee formula for when it's acceptable. So some of the things, now maybe I'm wrong on you. Maybe your organizations are different. Maybe it's only the Yankee farmers that I live with who still think that way. But I can only tell you that in saving farmland, if I hadn't been able to build a coalition in our state of the Junior League and the Garden Clubs and the teachers' organizations and the foresters, would you believe, I never would have got anything through the legislature if I had to depend on my farm friends who were going to benefit from the legislation. Because because there's still this feeling. I'm not talking now about an inability to speak out. I'm talking about an attitude towards activism, which is still the old stereotype. Me, an activist? Now, clearly, your farm clients may be the ones who participate in tractor caves, and you don't have this problem. But you know what I'm talking about. What I want to try and share with you is some of what we've learned about the actual techniques of activism and try and relate those to the history of activism in this country. First, let's talk a little bit about activism from the beginning of American society. If you didn't already know, the first activists were farmers. Shays' Rebellion, Bacon's Rebellion, all of those events that we read about in history class, those were farmers out there saying they didn't like the system. Or think of the foundation of the Grange, which to me is one of the great American stories of activism, of somebody who had an idea and was going to hang in there with it regardless and bring about changes that they felt was necessary. You know those stories so well, I'm not going to repeat them here. But I just want to make the point of reminding you that activism in the United States began with the farmers. It's true that it quieted down then for a long time until after the Civil War. But when the railroad rates and other issues brought the Grange and your own organization and others into being, farmers again became among the most potent activists. I guess my question to you is, can we now take this diminished portion of the population and find a way to, A, make them enough like activists that they will be really heard? Because you and I know that we can't do it for them. It's got to be them there at the grassroots. It's every farmer, not just us, as their spokesperson. Can we take this 4%, whatever the current figure is, and make them be heard? And secondly, can we find a way to get everybody else to buy in to this relatively narrow way of approaching activist causes that's going to have to result from such a tiny group being the leaders? Let me tell you just a little something about my own experience in activism so you'll be able to know what my biases are, because I clearly have them. Our practice represents two kinds of people, primarily. We do this by choice because it's where the fun is, in my opinion. We either represent people who want to change the world, activist movements, or we represent people who are being changed by the world, the target of activism. We are pretty much dealing with them every day. Some of the things I've learned may be instructive. First, let me tell you a little story about my most famous activist client, the anti-nuclear movement. I was representing many of the environmental institutions in the Northeast, and when I say I always mean our firm, because there are a number of us, and frankly, I go out and give speeches and they do the work. But I was representing a number of these organizations, and I got a call one day from an elderly woman in Vermont. She was clearly elderly because of her voice, I could tell. And she said, "I must come and see you." Well, I don't know if you know any elderly women from Vermont, but when they say they're going to come and see you, you say yes right off, because you know there's no sense in saying no. So about 2 days later, she showed up, and I was busy and impatient. She was about 80 years old. This was in 1968. And she had white gloves that came up to here. Now, even in 1968, women did not, well, they didn't wear white gloves at all, for the most part, and they certainly didn't wear these long ones. With her was another woman who was crippled, and she had one of these aluminum fences that they carry with them and sort of walk forward. So we ushered these two women into our conference room in our old farmhouse and went through all the amenities, and I'm looking at my watch, wondering what's going on. How soon I can get back to work. And finally I said to one of them, I said, "What is it that you wanted us to do for you?" And she said, "Well," she says, "you know that nuclear plant that they're building over on the Connecticut River?" I said, yep, "you mean the plant in Vernon, Vermont, the Yankee Atomic. It's about 99% complete. It's going to get its license soon." "Yep," she says, "that's the one." I said, "Well, what do you want us to do?" She says, "We want you to stop it." And I said, "Well, but I've heard and said it's 99% completed. All they have to do is get their NRC license. They're going to open." She says, "Yes, I know." But she says, "My family came to Brattleboro in about 1650. She says, "I live near the plant, and I listened to my friend Albert, who's the chairman of the power company and who's in all my clubs and churches and so forth. And he told me it was perfectly safe, and I didn't pay any attention. And then," she says, "I started reading He says, now I'm convinced it isn't safe. So I'll have to do the only thing that a self-respecting citizen can do, stop the plan. Well, these two little old ladies formed a thing called the New England Coalition Against Nuclear Pollution. It was the absolute beginnings of the organized anti-nuclear movement. I don't have to tell you that they've been rather effective. They've spread this throughout the world. They used the most conservative techniques possible. She went right on wearing her white gloves for the 4 years I represented her. They would go everywhere, and in her ladylike, almost imperious way, as an 80-year-old woman whose family had been in New England since they found it, she could talk to people and make them respond. A far cry from the typical view of the nuclear activists at the Seabrook plant near my home, where they cut fences and lie in front of trucks and fight with the National Guard. She's always been a lesson to me. And the lesson that she's been is to show me that there is in Americans this strain, maybe among a few of us, maybe among the opinion leaders or the early adopters, but this strain that I have a responsibility and I can do something about it. Well, in her case, she did do something about it. Now, you may agree or disagree with her view on the issue, but the thing that I find it impossible to disagree with is her right to take that position and to do everything she can to make it public. Now, if I understand anything about our professional work in public relations, it is based entirely on that right. From her, I learned a number of things, her and others that we've worked with. One of them is that no one person, no one institution is ever completely liked or disliked, ever completely trusted or mistrusted. The result of that is that we tend to relate organizations and persons to the whole of humanity, so that if we trust an organization generally, nonetheless, as soon as there is word of scandal or negative beings, we flip over to our mistrust side and relate that somewhat trusted organization to the whole of humanity, in which we know there are a lot of untrustworthy people. So that it is impossible, in my view, to nail down trust or being liked, if you want to phrase it that way. This is not something you can cast in concrete for more than a week. If you don't believe me, just take a look at any number of institutions that have had excellent reputations. Bad word comes along about them, and the first thing you know, everybody is willing to say, well, gee whiz. In short, people are not known for defending institutions when the issue is merely entertainment. And that's one of the key things that we've learned about dealing in activist issue situations, is that for most of the public, that is what a nice struggle between the activists and whoever they are arguing with is. It's entertainment. So the first rule that we have taken up is the rule of theater. Our strategic planning process on an issue is strictly that of drama. We actually draw up a script. Who is the knight in shining armor? Who is the dragon? Who is the heroine that is being attacked? Who is the chorus over here and the stage manager? And we have found, funnily enough, or perhaps accurately enough, that when we start looking at it that way, we avoid that temptation to be logical, and we start seeing it the way people see it, and that's how they see it. Since the role in a crisis, in an issue, in an activist confrontation, is the one that I listed over here of keeping the organization from suffering, the key point, of course, is to see that the public views it in a way that we don't suffer. And so we have used this theatrical method of trying to paint our people as the knight in shining armor, and understanding that to the public, they're just standing there without any real ownership of the outcome. All they know is that it's better than news when there aren't any confrontations. Much more exciting to watch TV when there's a lot of this going on than when it's just rather dull announcements out of the federal government. You might think about the theatrical method, and if you will think about it, you'll be able to look back and see how the great activists in this country have been affected. Let's go way back to the beginning, the very, very beginning. Sam Adams. Sam thought there were a few things wrong with the American linkage with the mother country, as you know, and so he felt that he had the responsibility to change it. Now, what did Sam do? Did he go around and hold learned discourses with all the people in New England? Forget it. He didn't do dumb things like that. He got them all dressed up in Indian hats, and they went down to the harbor one dark night, and they threw all the tea overboard and then ran like hell before the British troops came. Now, history in its grandiose way, you know, calls this the Boston Tea Party. But any of us as practitioners will immediately see it as a staged event. That's all it was. It was no different than my client coming and picketing you. It was a rigged up deal. It was a staged event to focus opinion, to focus awareness and interest on the issue that that represented. In this case, the issue, of course, is the tax on tea. So what do? You pitch it overboard, you dress up like Indians to give it a little stage presence, a little entertainment. And within 2 days, everybody in the American colonies knew that there were some folks in Boston that had a question about this policy. Could you imagine how long it would have taken him with the news media that day to inform those same people by writing letters and getting it in the Boston Post? It would have taken forever. But I suggest to you that today, even with our mass communications techniques, if we can come up with a Boston Tea Party, it'll be known immediately. Case in point, Seabrook Nuclear Plant. Seabrook lies 10 miles away from me. I have no official position on Seabrook because I am chairman of the Land Use Planning Agency in that region, which has to decide whether it's go or no-go. So you're not going to pin me down. But I will tell you this, that I have gone there with the activists, dressed about like this, the second time that they had a sit-in, about 2,000 of them on the site of the plant. I got my jeans on, or my shorts on, and walked along behind the activists. And I learned some things that were very helpful to me. And that is that when established organizations are the subject of the attack, that the government doesn't play fair. Because standing in front of me was a guy that I knew to be a cop. And right here I could see his handcuffs bulging out of his shorts. And there he was, dressed in there, saying, "Come on, gang, let's go." You see, he was just another activist. I think that subverts the system. And indeed, it was proven so in this case. Out of the Seabrook situation, you may not know it, came a New Hampshire Supreme Court decision that the role of the police in an activist confrontation, get this now, the role of the police in activist confrontation is first to protect the First Amendment rights of the protesters. That's first. The right of free speech or symbolic action, says this Supreme Court decision, is more important than protecting the property rights that may be involved, particularly since an activist who destroys property is immediately subject to legitimate arrest, and none of us would argue with that. Well, I think that this question of confrontation, whether it be by my little old lady friend with her long gloves, or by the folks who tried to cut the fence and go over and actually occupy land, has a great similarity. Let me see if I can paint for you some of these similarities. Incidentally, if you wonder who's using activist techniques today, you may be interested in a little list that I made just from recent issues of things we reported in PR Reporter. The anti-abortionist movement was doing similar things to the Seabrook people. Of course, the tractor kids are somewhat ancient history now. The American Nazi Party has been using these techniques, but so has the Jewish Defense League. The Ku Klux Klan certainly does, but so do the ERA supporters. Parents are organizing and picketing all over the country because they don't like a textbook, or they don't like a sex education course, or they don't have a winning high school basketball coach. And of course, I just passed one of those yesterday. I saw in a paper the next day that they fired the coach because he obviously didn't win in the court of public opinion as well as he didn't win on the basketball court. But the other group that today is perhaps the most active of any is the religious community. If you've been following the arms limitation debate at all, you know that a fascinating thing has happened. And this, I think, may change, well,
This may show the effect of activism inside an organization. I'm speaking now of the Roman Catholic Church. The Roman Catholic Church is an organization which I think would have to be described by its best friends as somewhat dictatorial. I mean, the Pope is infallible and we're supposed to believe the bishop and all that kind of stuff. It's not really a public participation group. But now we have a church with all of its muscle, if it ever decides to use it, that has begun actually applying its gospels to social situations. So we have bishops across the country taking public stands against a weapon which they consider to be outrageous, nuclear or hydrogen weapons. We have an institution which is now sort of split on this issue. And we may see soon a dictatorial organization transformed to a public participation organization, because the only way I see that that institution can avoid a schism which would be destructive is simply to turn it around and let the members debate the decision, rather than having the priest, the bishop, pass the decision down on high. It's an interesting aspect of activism that it is now, in other words, beginning to change the nature of organizations internally. Not an easy thing to do when you're dealing with one like the Catholic Church. Let me point out one other thing that's happening to you, to us today, and that is that people tend to become activists on issues that really there's not almost little they can do about. In Boston a year ago, based on a referendum passed by the state which said that towns could not raise their tax rates, the city decided that all it could do would be to cut police and fire services. So they closed a police station in East Boston. Police Boston, as you may know, sits across the Charles River from Boston, and to get there you have to go through a tunnel, and right across the river is Logan Airport. So the folks in East Boston got a bright idea. They took one look at activist techniques and they said, I'll tell you what we'll do. Every morning at going to work time and every night at work leaving time, we will just picket in front of the tunnel entrances. Well, the result was absolute chaos. Traffic was backed up for hours and hours and hours. And to me, this was a perversion of the activist process, because those poor drivers could not change that budget policy. They were innocent victims. It was a little bit like the ERA technique of not holding conferences and conventions in the hotels in states which had not passed ERA, as if somehow the ERA were going to be voted on by all the bellboys and busmen rather than by the legislature.
Yeah.
I recite it as a bad example, but as evidence of how completely these kind of techniques, these principles, have been accepted by perfectly good conservative American citizens. East Boston is a community about 90% Italian, family, very family oriented. This is probably the first time these people have protested anything, and yet there they were lining up cars 10 miles away. I think it's an augury of what we can expect unless our organization find ways to be responsive to folks before the issue becomes one that requires activism. I think there's a way to do that. I don't know whether this is what your speaker yesterday told you or not. I don't know if he even covered this, but let me just quickly zip through it. I spoke this morning about being a strategic planner. We try to chart issues for our clients, and we do it on a scale of four. We find there are four kinds of issues. The first kind of issue is a latent issue. I mean, it isn't really an issue. It's just in our heads, or from history, we can see that it could be an issue, but it's still latent. Then we chart, and by the way, that's the one we pay the most attention to. We try to manage our public relationships, our policies, in such a way that this issue will never, never, never emerge, become an emerging issue. And I'll show you in a minute a technique that we use for charting latent issues. Of course, once the issue begins to get a little popularity, it emerges, becomes an emerging issue. Clearly, that's the time to deal with it if we haven't been able to stop it. Unfortunately, emerging issues become current or hot issues all too soon,
particularly if we stiffen the resistance in any way. And once we've dealt with the issue, and we think, well, thank goodness, that's over, we're now finding that it isn't over at all, but that there are, in fact,